After dropping serious dollars at Bergdorf and Saks, we spent a good hour in Ray's Beauty Supply on 8th Avenue getting every product needed to maintain our divaness. Hanging with the girls was great, but you can best believe I always had calls out to a couple of my men. Within a day or so of arriving back in the city, I was having phone sex with Ken around 1 in the morning when someone buzzed up from downstairs. To my surprise, it was Gregory Hines, who had just returned from the continent. He was a bit tipsy and had brought over some African wine from his trip. I suspected that he didn't realize I was back in town and that it was Debbie Burrell whom he was really looking for. I had sublet my apartment to her while I was on the road. When Gregory and I performed together the previous year, our flirtation was pretty minor, and I was among the few women on the Broadway scene with whom Gregory hadn't had sex. Although, there was this one time after the first act in Ubi. We came off stage exhausted from the last number, an up-tempo piece called Jazz, that ended with about 15 roundhouse kicks. The dressing rooms were several flights up, and I just couldn't make it. I sat on the stairs, and as Gregory climbed toward me, I made a request. Jennifer, heaving to catch her breath.
Gregory, I'm so thirsty, but I'm just too tired to go all the way back down for some water. Could you get me some?
Gregory, sweetly.
Jennifer, I'm tired too.
Jennifer, in joking whisper.
Gregory, if you go get me some water, I'll let you suck my tit.
Swing! Gregory took off like the Roadrunner. In a matter of moments, he was back with a cup of water. When I finished drinking, Gregory stepped toward me. I said, Gregory, now you know damn well I was playing. He smiled and said, a promise is a promise, Jennifer. And with that, Gregory gently laid me backwards on the floor, opened my robe, revealed my right titty, and proceeded to suck it vigorously for at least a couple of minutes. I squirmed in protest. Hey, I had to act like I didn't like it. But I probably came twice in that brief session. A few of my castmates saw what was going on and shook their heads. But I didn't care. They were probably as turned on as I was. So when Gregory showed up in my apartment with the wine, there was no hesitation on either of our parts, and we quickly took our relationship to a new level on the kitchen counter. We were pretty wild and somehow wound up naked, with me riding piggyback and shushing Gregory from making so much noise as he trotted out of my apartment, down the hallway, singing loudly. Like bare-ass fools, we hopped onto the elevator to the lobby, and Gregory galloped around the concierge desk a couple of times before we made it back to the apartment without being seen by anyone. Oh, to be young, silly, and free. Years later, I started to regale some of my friends with my Gregory story. My good friend Lorraine Phil stopped me cold. Oh, Jennifer, Gregory told everybody that story the day after it happened. During my break from the UB tour, I enjoyed dates with several guys from the corral of men I had assembled in New York. Besides Ken, there was Ron and Patrick. But then I was forced to go to Roosevelt Hospital with a raging yeast infection. The burning was terrible. Fortunately, it cleared up by the time Miguel called. He was back from the Dominican Republic and invited me to Brooklyn. When he opened his apartment door, we fell upon each other and I sucked his entire body. I loved him so much.
much. No other man got this kind of attention from me. Here he still wanted to marry me, yet he knew I'd been with other men while we were apart. I didn't mean to treat him badly. It's just how things had been between us for years. The first night back on the UB tour in Kansas City, I met a conventioneer named Nick at the hotel bar. A day later, we had sex. I felt terrible. How could I have sex with a stranger right after sharing such a beautiful time with Miguel? He deserved better from me. Nick showed me a picture of his girlfriend back home. Her name was Becky, and she was a home economics teacher. He called me from the airport. Journal entry. Poor baby. He's in love. My family drove from St. Louis to see me in the show. On one hand, I loved having them. But on the other hand, I felt a higher level of stress because I wanted them to be proud of me, especially Mama. She seemed to always find something to criticize. We all ate at Gates Barbecue, and I was so happy that my sister Jackie stayed with me in my hotel room. Her son, Michael Quentin, was a toddler at the time and shared my bed. It was so cozy and sweet until I woke up with a full diaper in my face. The combination of my guilt about Miguel and the stress of having my family in town made me irritable, which caused some bad blood with a couple of members of the UB company. I felt remorse about being on the outs with my castmates, but I just didn't know how to fix it. I lacked certain social graces. I had no boundaries. I teased and joked and often went too far. I also always flat out spoke my mind, resulting in people either loving me or hating me. A week later, during the opening night reception in Boston, I drank too much and basically acted a fool, even jumping onto the piano and rudely hushing the crowd so that I could sing to them. When I finally took a breather, a beautiful blonde woman who had been in the audience approached me. "Your performance was extraordinary. We just had to meet you." This is how I met my friend, Timmy Hyde. She took my hand and, in a refined Boston accent, introduced her boyfriend, Billy. Timmy was gorgeous, in a beaded silk dress, and dripped of culture and wealth. I guess she was in her mid-40s. We chatted a while, and I became enchanted with this elegant, worldly woman who thought I was brilliantly talented. As the evening wore on, I went with my castmates to a disco where I continued to drink, talk trash, and act out. By the time I got back to my room, I was a drunken mess. Crying, I called Debbie and Miguel, but their words of comfort did not help much. I thought about calling Mama, but instead I called Miss Mitchell, one of my mother figures, who I knew would comfort, not criticize me. Afterwards, I still felt sad as I looked at myself in the mirror and thought, God, what's wrong with me? The show went great. So what's wrong, baby? Journal entry. 2:30 a.m. I failed. I need a cause in my life. I tried to keep my mind on what Timmy had said. Was I really extraordinary? I felt guilt about Miguel, at odds with my castmates, and completely fucked up. A couple of days later, I met Timmy and Billy for drinks. They brought along an older man named Jack. He was an alcoholic, which I saw as dangerous and exciting. I thought, so what? I'm all those things, too. I brought him back to my room and had sex with him.
I might have gotten gonorrhea from him. Or maybe it was Nick from Kansas City. It scared me. And I was much more careful from then on. On matinee days, I left the theater and aimlessly wandered the streets of Chinatown. Traveling and working with people in close quarters every day was becoming increasingly difficult. The thing is, while I was clearly an asset to the company, I didn't know how to be part of a team offstage. Ever since childhood, I had been the lone wolf. There were 7 kids in my family, and they paired off into 3 couples, leaving me the odd one out. With the neighborhood kids, I put myself above the crowd in order to lead. I became the alpha wolf. I was running the show. I would get loud and bullying and shut the shit down. In high school, my nickname was Killer, on account of my sharp tongue and pushy nature. In college, I was dubbed Majestic for my commanding theatrical abilities and queenly behavior. Throughout my adolescence and young adulthood, people had catered to me because I was talented, cute, and charismatic. Often, I received special treatment. I would get people to laugh and be forgiven for my transgressions. As a result, I did not develop certain social skills, collaboration and conciliation, that were necessary in a touring theater company and in life in general. When I became a professional and show business added glamour to a persona that was already bullying, killer, and majestic, I emerged a diva. Now there's a two-edged term. It can be the ultimate compliment, indicating a woman's mastery of her art and often her fabulous demeanor. But the term can also be an insult, describing despicable grandiosity and disregard for others. Yes, a diva is admirable and a queen, but she's also a self-centered, demanding bitch. During the Yubi tour, my divitude flourished. Unfortunately, in both senses of the word. My shortcomings, combined with a working culture that breeds drama and competitiveness, caused me to continue to have friction and disappointment with the other gypsies. I was sort of the baby, straight out of college. They had been pounding the pavement and surviving for years. And here I come, fresh from 4 years of classical training and living in a dorm. In an unconscious move to protect myself, I became obnoxiously overconfident. I am the best, whether you know it or not. Journal entry. I wish I knew who I really am. Why the fuck am I here? Speaking of divas, when I went with several company members to see the incomparable singer Carmen McRae, the great George Benson was in the audience. Following the show, I went to Miss McRae's dressing room to tell her how much I appreciated all she contributed to the art of singing. To my surprise, she squeezed my hand and openly flirted with me. It made me uncomfortable. Remember, it was 1980, and lesbianism was still pretty taboo. I had never had a problem with people's sexuality, but be you man, woman, goat, rooster, or rhinoceros, don't be squeezing my hand with your sweaty palm. I left the nightclub in a foul mood, feeling frustrated that Carmen McRae was a big star and I wasn't. During dinner with Terry and a couple of others, I boasted endlessly about my own talent and grandeur. It quickly became too much for my companions to take. I wound up in a showdown with UB hairstylist Breelum Daniels, Something's going on with you, Jennifer. It's like you're hiding the real Jennifer.
What?
It pissed me off. Instead of responding like an adult, I said,
yeah, and it's that other Jennifer who gets the great reviews that keep you your job, ain't it?
I stood up and stalked out of the restaurant and walked for hours, trying to absorb Breland's comment. The next morning, the Boston Herald featured me in a spread with a half-page photo taken in front of the theater. I was ecstatic and mailed copies of the review to Mama, as I always did. But my joy was fleeting. I was feeling unnerved, isolated, and alone. Now that I was living my dream, why was I sad and confused all the time? I especially could not brush away the dark moods at night. Even as a child, I had experienced extreme sadness, often sobbing silently into my pillow before sleeping. I'd sometimes awaken in the middle of the night and write in my journal, or doodle, doodle, doodle. Otherwise, I often felt as though I could not control my anxiety, my scattered brain, or my impulsive, rushing speech. I spent a lot of time alone engaging in activities that would bring me peace, such as cleaning the apartment or braiding, unbraiding, and rebraiding my hair. Things reached a low point after the showdown with Breland in the restaurant. I got even more depressed when Miguel called to say he could not come to Boston for a visit. I missed him so much. Then my crazy ass called Jack, of all fucking people. He answered, mumbled, and the line went dead. Alcoholic. Journal entry. I feel so scared, empty, lonely. Not really alive. No real cause. Nothing. But on stage, nothing can hurt me. Toward the end of the Boston run, I flew to New York City a couple of times to spend time with Miguel. I was disappointed to find he was not in the mood for making love. He had more pressing issues on his mind. Nobody was hiring Dominicans, even one with a PhD and 2 master's degrees. I felt for him deeply. Journal entry. As God is my witness, I love this man. The next morning, I flew back to Boston on the shuttle, did the show, got drunk, and called Maurice, Mr. Garden Gnome, in Chicago. Within 2 days, I met a new man at a disco, an Ethiopian named Joe. I wrapped my legs around him as we danced, reaching for his third leg. I took him straight home. But God bless him, y'all. His dick was so small that I told him, honey, the only place you can put that is in my ear. I faked a sudden headache and escorted him out with a smile. Po' bastard. Boston was done, and we moved to Toronto, Canada. I was excited the entire trip to Toronto because it was the first time someone in my immediate family had left the United States. We stayed at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, with a pool and sauna. It was a lot nicer than the usual dumps they put us in. I had yet to meet a man in Toronto, so I hung out a lot with the other gypsies. The museum with Donna Ingram, a street fair with Billy McDaniels. My friend Roderick Seibert and I went to see Alien. He was from Toronto, so his mother cooked dinner for us at her home. I gobbled up her delicious stuffed cabbage, sweet yams, and cornbread. Later, Roderick and I went and did the show. The reviews were great, singling out my performance. I was getting ovations. But it was becoming the same old, same old. a routine. In addition, the pressure of the backstage drama was getting tough. I was seriously thinking about leaving the tour. I was unhappy and welcomed some one-on-one time with Terry, a true friend. She invited me to her room, and we talked about me becoming more aware of other people's space and being more disciplined. I asked her if the other cast members liked me. She said, "Jennifer, everybody loves you. You're talented, you're fun, you're fabulous. You just come off as intimidating. You need to calm down, girl." Thank goodness we got off the subject and started sharing our excitement about going to see Tina Turner the next day. I splurged and bought a beautiful blouse for the occasion for $29.99. We pulled up at the York Hotel. We knew we'd have good seats as we received special attention in every city because we were performing at the big theaters. When Tina came on stage and opened with Disco Inferno, my whole body was so filled with electricity, my head damn near exploded. There she was, all legs, hips, arms, and hair. So much fucking hair. It was all I could do not to just run the fuck up there and fall to my knees and weep. All hail the queen. We were allowed backstage. Tina's assistant opened the door and led us to her dressing room. And there she stood. The Miss Rollin' on the River, Miss Shake a Tail Feather, Miss Nutbush City Limits, Miss Rock Me Baby, Rock Me all night long. Tina's legs were as long as the Mississippi River. Though she was just standing there, it was as if her hips were still gyrating. As she opened her arms to embrace me, her wingspan was that of a golden eagle. And in that raspy voice, she said, "How's everybody?" I was speechless. Here was my opportunity to bow, and I bowed lower than I ever had. We all hung out in her dressing room for a little while, and when we left, our feet never touched the ground. By the way, there's a rumor on the internet that I auditioned to play Tina in the 1993 movie version of her life, What's Love Got to Do with It? I did not. The reason I wasn't asked to audition for the role of Tina was because my titties were too big. Too bad. 'Cause I could have sung the shit out of that motherfucker and acted the hell out of it, too. Bitch better have my money. Anyway, nobody could have played the role as well as Angela. Lo and behold, the director of What's Love called me during the casting process to tell me they wanted me to play Tina Turner's mother. I was just about to say, "Fuck you." When he told me how much money I would be paid. Before I hung up, I told him, "Well, for that kind of money, I'll play the daddy." That, ladies and gentlemen, is how I began my career as the mother of Black Hollywood. I played the hell out of Zelma Bullock. The real Zelma Bullock loved me in the role, even if she didn't like how the film portrayed her overall. A year or so later, after the movie came out, I was in a vitamin store. I heard a woman say, "Aileen, come over here in this aisle and show me which one of these vitamins I should get." Wait a minute. Do I recognize that voice? And the name Aileen. Could it be? Oh, my God. Oh, my God, my God. I stage whispered to my friend, "I think that's Tina Turner's mama." "It's Selma Bullock." I went into the next aisle and saw an older woman in tight pants. She had Tina's form and was quite fit for a woman her age. I approached her timidly. I said, "Miss Bullock?" She turned around, the spitting image of beautiful Tina, and grabbed me and hugged me so tight.
She pulled back with water in her eyes and said, I wanted to be so dressed up when I met you.
I knew what she meant and felt humbled. When she passed in 1999, it was an honor to sing at her funeral. Apparently, in all that heightened excitement while we were in Tina's dressing room, I cracked a joke that was insulting to one of my cast members, Cheryl. When I got to the theater the next day, she ambushed me. I was shocked by her fury over what I saw as innocent joking and teasing. She looked so hurt, and I felt so sorry. I apologized profusely. It was rare that anyone would confront me at all, especially like this. As Terry had said, I had a way of distancing people when they'd get too close. It was a moment of insight for me. I wanted to make amends immediately. Fortunately, she listened when I explained that I meant no malice toward her. She softened, and after the show, we went to the hotel and watched TV together. The TV news headlines were all about the eruption of Mount St. Helens in Washington State. Volcanic eruption seemed an appropriate metaphor for my demeanor in those days. Show after show, man after man. The blindness of persecuting my colleagues and thinking they would be okay with it. I felt sorry for myself. I knew I wasn't a bad person, but it didn't stop me from carrying on and being argumentative. I felt out of control of my behavior or blamed others for my treatment of them. I felt my brain was moving too rapidly, and I was constantly chasing after myself. Except for Terry, nobody seemed to be on my side. I hung around Roderick a lot, even though he got on my nerves. One time he tried to undermine me by telling everybody I was a lesbian. Foolish boy. Given my track record, how far do you think that rumor went? Hanging out with the girls and the gay boys was fun. But I was on the hunt for a straight man. I started to recognize that I needed regular sex. Without it, I felt scattered and moody, like I was coming apart at the seams. As they say, the show went on. I was invited to sing my handyman on Canada's national morning TV show. I was so happy afterwards that I called Miguel, but we fell into the same old fight as he pleaded the usual. Come back to me. Let's get married. We should have children, Yennefer. 5. Love versus Dream Girls. A couple of weeks into the Toronto run of the UB National Tour, the earth turned over. I met Thomas Lindsay, the tour's new stage manager. Our eyes locked, and everything changed for both of us. Thomas was smart, generous, sweet, short, and freckled. I couldn't wait to kiss his lips. I couldn't wait to feel his skin. And maybe Terry suggesting that I calm down helped me not to jump his bones immediately. Thomas was a really great stage manager who everybody liked. We talked until 2:30 a.m. the first time we met. We had dinner the next day. It was so nice to be with him. On our day off, we went to the Yorkville neighborhood, had ice cream, and saw The Empire Strikes Back. We walked home. It was a beautiful, romantic night. Around this time, a woman I knew, Kimako Baraka, called about a musical review, Foreplay, that she wanted to produce with me and Loretta Devine in the cast. I was intrigued by the title alone. Kimako, also known as Sandra Lee Jones, was the sister of the famous writer and activist Leroy Jones, now known as Amiri Baraka. I saw Foreplay as my way out of UB, and arranged with Kimako to fly to New York City later in the month to audition. I told Terry I planned to give my notice to quit the show. I didn't tell Terry about Thomas. She would have said, "Girl, don't shit where you eat." I knew I was falling in love with him. He was a good man, born and raised in the Midwest. A gentleman, even. He always opened the door for me, would let me carry anything. And yes, he gave me the last bite of food. I always found that so sexy. I had become a pool shark in college, but when we played, I let him win, because when the real moment of truth came, I wanted to be sure I had never threatened his manhood. I wanted that first time to be real good. Thomas had so much going for him that I wanted this relationship to grow and last. I didn't really know a lot about the internal workings of men. My father had been mostly absent, and my older brothers pretty much had nothing to do with my little crazy ass running around always making trouble. One memorable evening, Thomas and I went to a club called the Chicken Deli to see Earl Father Hines, the great jazz pianist. We still had not made love, which was an indication that he was special to me. I was a bit tipsy when we returned to the hotel, but we parted and went to our separate rooms. When Thomas and I finally made love, it was wonderful. We had both known it was inevitable. In the morning, we had breakfast on his balcony. I wanted Thomas to know who I was, what he was getting himself into. Rather than have an adult conversation with him, I tried to shock him by sitting on the balcony topless. Topless, while workers in the other building across the way watched us eat. My inability to tap into my emotions and talk about them warped my thinking and caused me to test Thomas by pushing him away. This is who I am. Run while you've got the chance. But he stayed. He accepted me. The company had rented a bus to take us all to Niagara Falls that morning. So when my castmate, the ever so fierce Leslie Dockery, went to my room to get me, of course I wasn't there. She, along with the rest of the company, figured I'd spent the night with Thomas. They all sat on the bus and gave me the side eye because I had had sex with the stage manager. At Niagara Falls, the sound, the roar. It was my first waterfall ever. One of the most overwhelming experiences of my life. The falls were so unbelievably loud. I swear, I thought I had died. When I got off the bus, I said, "What the fuck is that sound?" "Jennifer, it's the falls." "Where is it?" I ran like a crazy person in the direction of the sound and found myself looking straight at the famous horseshoe, Niagara's largest waterfall. At that moment, I knew there was a God. It was a sight to see, y'all. A sight to see. I took a brief break from my new love affair with Thomas to fly home to sing "You Light Up My Life" at my Aunt Janice's wedding in St. Louis. Later that night, Mama and I watched TV, and I talked to her about Daddy, life, and love. I was hungry for anything that made sense. I asked her about her pastor at First Baptist. I was sidestepping. Pastor Hurd had molested me as a teenager. When it happened, I told Mama. But the issue was never resolved, and we never discussed it. The experience shattered our already tenuous relationship, and for many years I wondered whether Mama was in my corner. The next morning, Mama made breakfast and told me she had arranged for Pastor Hurd to take me to the airport. In his car, I disconnected from my history with this person in order to survive the present situation. I repressed my rage and chit-chatted with him. This is what trauma does to you. It shuts you down and shuts you up. Just like the hundreds, thousands, and millions of women who are molested and say nothing. On the way back to Toronto, I stopped in Manhattan and turned out the Foreplay audition. Foreplay was planned to tour several capital cities in Europe. I was excited at the prospect of becoming an international star like Josephine Baker. When I returned to Canada, I immediately called Kimako and learned I got the part. I hardly had time to celebrate before I was on stage belting Roll, Jordan, Roll. I started to call Mom and tell her the good news, but instead I called one of my mother figures, Graziella Abel, the producer and choreographer I'd worked with a few years earlier in Baggy Pants. I knew that she would express authentic happiness and pride in my accomplishments. Then I quickly showered and ran to Thomas's room, where I had him and had him and had him again. It was like Thomas and I were on our honeymoon. We spent all of our time together enjoying Toronto's great restaurants and cultural venues. Once we declared our love for each other, my interest in other men disappeared. I was a demanding partner, but Thomas didn't mind. We made love morning, noon, and night. As soon as we were back in the city, Thomas took me to the Bronx to meet his family. It became obvious that Thomas was less interested in introducing me than in proving to his older brother, who was a nightmare combination of cigarettes, liquor, and barbecue, that Thomas could get a hot girlfriend. I was so glad to be back in New York City. My days were once again a blur of activity, rushing to and from dance classes and voice lessons, spending time with Mark Brown and Bobby, or hanging out at a popular watering hole like Possible 20 and Barrymore's. My favorite restaurant was a Chinese-Cuban place called Numero Uno, just a block away from my apartment. I swear I ate their shrimp egg foo young almost daily. I also took great pleasure in sneaking into Broadway shows after the intermission to see the second and third acts for free. Despite being home, my bouts of sadness seemed to be getting worse. There were nights when I would allow my sorrow to consume me, making a mini-production of it by watching in the mirror as the tears streamed down my cheeks. The crying became habitual. It was a place of comfort in itself as I spoke aloud to my reflection. Tomorrow will be a good day, Jenny. The tunnel was dark and long. Meanwhile, Foreplay rehearsals were starting soon at the Minskoff Theater. The composer-director was Chapman Roberts, a highly respected Broadway music director and arranger. The cast included Loretta Devine, Edmund Wesley, Nat Morris, Jackie Lowe, and Steve Simeon. But then a day passed, and I realized I hadn't heard from Thomas. When we finally connected on the phone, he told me he wanted time off. I listened as he talked about needing time for quiet reflection, alone. I rushed directly to his apartment, and we made sweet, beautiful love. I was hoping our relationship would work out, but the impact of Thomas's flagging interest was that I reopened my life to other men. If I couldn't get my drug from Thomas, then I had to find another pusher man. In late summer, Michael Peters phoned and asked me to audition for a new show he was co-choreographing with the director Michael Bennett called Project 9. 4 years earlier, in 1976, Bennett had garnered worldwide acclaim as director and co-choreographer of A Chorus Line, which won 9 Tonys and the Pulitzer Prize for drama. Project 9 was the brainchild of playwright Tom Eyen and the composer Henry Krieger. The two had been inspired by the actress Nell Carter to develop a story about black backup singers titled One Night Only. The show was renamed Project 9. But then Carter left in 1978 to appear in the soap opera Ryan's Hope, and the idea was abandoned. The next year, the show was renamed Big Dreams and brought back to life because Michael Bennett became interested. The workshop resumed with Jennifer Holliday, a gospel singer, as Carter's replacement. In the cast also were Ben Harney, Obababatunde, and Cleavant Derricks. Holliday became upset that her character, Effie White, died at the end of the first act, and she quit. Eyen, Bennett, and Krieger continued to develop the musical while they looked for a new Effie. Between dance classes, I taxied to a rehearsal space on 19th Street to audition for Effie. I was thrilled that my friends were involved, Cheryl Lee Ralph, Loretta Devine, and Shirley Black Brown, who had become Michael Peters' assistant. Nevertheless, in my mind, this production was not a huge opportunity. After all, I had already been in 2 Broadway shows, so the idea of being part of a workshop seemed a bit of a step backwards. When I met Tom Eyen at the audition, I immediately disliked him. He came across as a stereotypical, cruel queen who found joy in belittling his actors. The next day, Michael Peters and Shirley Black Brown called to tell me that I turned out the audition and they suspected I would get the role. I didn't have time to worry about Big Dreams. I was rehearsing foreplay and taking classes. But mostly, I was being forced to come to terms with the fact that Thomas wanted to end our relationship. I was hurt and numb when he told me. I never said this was a steady thing, but when I went to his place, we made love. We just could not let each other go. And for the next 8 fucking years, we became locked in that old song by the Stylistics, Break Up to Make Up. In September, a whole month after the audition, I got the call and started working on the Big Dreams workshop. The music was outrageously fabulous. I remember listening to Krieger create the chords around the bass line for Stepping to the Bad Side. Ah, the colors and the levels. How he stopped the music and allowed Loretta to riff Ain't No Party was phenomenal. This wasn't Hollywood. These were thespians, giants to be of the theater. I loved Michael Bennett. He said to me, Jennifer, your mind is like a computer. Not to mention your talent. It was clear also that Michael Peters believed in me, while the other bosses were lukewarm. By the time I joined, the rest of the cast had been rehearsing for weeks and were quite polished. I was intimidated and did a lot of overacting and overcompensating. Where Yubi had been a musical review, Big Dreams was my first book musical as a professional. This meant the show had more lines and required more acting. Plus, Effie was the lead character. The pressure. And that song, And I Am Telling You I'm Not Going, the expectations. I just couldn't sing like Jennifer Holliday. Nobody in the world could. I always felt like they hired me, the trained actress, to develop the character, knowing all along they were going to hire Jennifer Holliday back for that voice. I played Effie in 2 mildly successful workshops of Big Dreams for the Niederlanders and the Schuberts, major production companies in the theater world. Shortly thereafter, when Tom Ian called and said, "We're going with Jennifer Holliday," it was clear he wanted me to break down on the phone. He was that kind of person. But it felt good to say to him, "I've got a job. I'm fine." As I was working on foreplay. "Thank you, and fuck you very much, Mr. Ian." What I'd missed out on didn't hit me until the billboards went up all over the city for the show, which had been renamed Dreamgirls. A spasm of pain went through me as I saw those images, thinking it could have been me. It was my first major professional disappointment. However, my pain was lessened by the knowledge that I would be paid throughout the entire run of Dreamgirls on Broadway for my contribution to creating the role of Effie in the workshop production. God bless Michael Bennett, and God bless Actors Equity. Foreplay had unraveled, but unfortunately not before a couple of my checks from Kimako had bounced. I was disappointed, but resumed my routine of dance class and auditions. During this period, I had begun to realize how soothing I found nature and began spending a lot of time during the day in Central Park. Almost every night you would find me holding court till the wee hours at piano bars and clubs like the Horn of Plenty and the Grand Finale. My crowd included Mark and Bobby, plus a revolving assortment of fabulous gypsies. Jack A. Harry, Shirley Black Brown, Pye Douglas, Yolanda Graves, Ebony Joanne, Julia Lima, Mel Johnson Jr., Janet Powell, Jeffrey V. Thompson, and Pauletta Pearson, who of course later married Denzel Washington. I got the call to go back on the UB National Tour. I was seeing a few guys, but was still trying to make things work with Thomas. But then he told me he planned to be all business, meaning no sex, when we went back on the tour. It didn't help things when he ran into Miguel in the lobby of my building. It was inevitable, I guess. Despite Thomas's pledges of celibacy, when we got to San Francisco, we were having daily sex, sometimes even in the dressing room, which I must admit was made hotter by the possibility of someone catching us. But more, it was a loving, romantic time for us in that beautiful city. Ghirardelli Square, Sausalito, the enchantment of foggy nights. San Francisco is still one of my favorite cities. The show was doing well, and yours truly was enjoying herself. I was a fucking beast on stage, laser-focused in my performance from the moment I set out for the Curran Theater each evening. I was staying at the apartment of Joe Kalmus, a friend from Webster. Joe was my scene partner when I competed for the Irene Ryan Acting Scholarship. Y'all know Granny from the Beverly Hillbillies, right? While I was in college. Before we went on stage at the semifinals in Nebraska, I took Joe aside, gripped her arm, and said, "Fuck this up and I will kill you." Pretty nasty thing to say to someone who's helping you out, huh? Well, Joe didn't fuck it up. But karma is a bitch. Because I fucked up and lost at the finals later that year at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. After Thomas and I had a fight one day, I went with Roderick to a small gathering at the hotel suite of the legend herself, the incomparable Lena Horne. After the show, Miss Horne invited us for a visit at the Fairmont Hotel, where she was staying at the time. She welcomed us into her suite, and then wrapped in at least two robes with several lush textured scarves around her neck, she reclined majestically on her long chair. She was coming down from her show and had three humidifiers running. I sat at Miss Horne's feet and drank every syllable of every word she spoke that night about show business, music, and politics. I was in the presence of someone I wanted to emulate. She was not just a performer. She was an activist who had stood up for black soldiers in the Second World War, and she had marched with Dr. King. This wasn't just a legend in front of me. This was a goddess. It was Lena Horne who turned her back on Hollywood, vowing to never play either a maid or a hooker. She was one of the most beautiful women I had ever seen. Ageless. I asked her, "Miss Horne, how do you stay so young?" She pointed to the humidifiers. "I live in moisture, and I surround myself with young people, baby." Nuff said. When the tour got to San Diego, there were more great reviews. Then there's the stunning Jennifer Lewis, whose delightfully naughty number leaves no doubt about what she means. It is impossible to tell whether the women in the show were chosen primarily for beauty or talent. Lewis's handyman number is merely a prelude to her sensational rendition of Roll, Jordan, Roll. I flew home over Christmas and then back to beautiful San Diego. Thomas and I were still going back and forth. I had had words with Terry and was feeling pretty lonely. As we welcomed 1981 amid glittery hats and horns at a New Year's Eve party, Terry drank a few too many and told me I was a superficial bitch. My feelings were hurt. I got drunk on Black Russians, wobbled back to my room, and handled things, if you know what I mean. The orgasm took me to the cold linoleum floor. Happy New Year, motherfuckers. The UB tour had a break, and I went back to New York. Around this time, Phil Valentine, who I'd been seeing since the previous year, became a big influence. I had not known anyone like him up until that point. A gorgeous man. Phil was a black cultural nationalist. Now, if you don't know what that is, Google it. And vegan, who owned a holistic health center in Brooklyn. I was searching for stability and a sense of clarity and inner peace. Phil provided some answers. Phil wanted me to get over the Jesus stuff. He believed Christianity had been forced upon enslaved black people as a way to control African Americans forever. He said what was most important was to take care of my health, especially my diet. He told me to try not to eat meat and to stick to more vegetables and fruit. He encouraged me to move my body every day with some kind of physical activity. And whatever you do, throw these cigarettes in the trash. He said firmly, "Look inside, Jennifer. Pay attention to your instincts. There's a song in everyone." I was really searching at the time. Along with Thomas and many friends in the theater community, I started attending services offered by the Unity Center of Practical Christianity, an organization that combines elements of Christianity with Eastern philosophies and metaphysics. Unity publishes the well-known and respected Daily Word. The church I grew up in had let me down, as it failed to be the safe and loving place it was meant to be when Pastor Hurd molested me. I sought God and thought Unity might hold some answers. The services were held at Avery Fisher Hall at Lincoln Center on Sunday mornings, led by Reverend Olga Butterworth and her husband, Reverend Eric Butterworth. I felt like I was going to church. I don't know that I fully understood what Unity was talking about, but I was captivated by the idea that the answers I desired about my purpose might, in fact, be inside me. I had not quite abandoned Jesus. I still hoped he would appear and let me know what the fuck I was supposed to do with this gift God had given me. But Unity fed me what I needed at the time. One Unity phrase that stayed with me for many years was, "Say yes." The concept jumped off the page and into my soul. To be all right with being all right. It comforted me. It meant to breathe. It meant to be kind and forgiving. Pay attention to the world around you. It meant everything I wanted for my spirit. Although many friends attended Unity, we did not discuss what we were learning. We had been raised Christian, but our religion was theater. We read the Daily Word, but really, our Bibles were Variety and Backstage. Jesus wasn't the only one I was waiting for. I expected to be rescued by my career savior, the person who would discover me. The one who would recognize my superior talents and take me to unseen heights of stardom. You know, like in the movies and all the books I'd read. Like Lana Turner at the counter in Schwab's Pharmacy. I imagined that I would be having a drink at the Russian Tea Room or doing high kicks in some nightclub, and my Aaron Russo or Mike Nichols would show up. Russo was the manager credited with boosting Bette Midler from performing in gay bathhouses to superstar status. Mike Nichols, the brilliant producer, director, and writer, took Whoopi Goldberg from street corner artist to a one-woman Broadway show. Incidentally, when I first met my dear friend Whoopi, she was doing stand-up in a tiny off-off-Broadway theater. Like my gypsy friends and I repeatedly said to one another, I was just waiting to be discovered, waiting for that one big break. During these days of the early 80s, I had no career guidance, no strategy. In fact, my whole life was all over the place. I couldn't sit still. I moved fast and talked fast, acting on every impulse. My thoughts raced from one thing to the next. I knew that my high energy helped me to get a lot of stuff done. But the energy often came hand in hand with high anxiety. So even as I rushed here and there, it always felt incomplete. Hollow. Like it was not enough. 6.
Ma'am, are you a delegate?
In early January 1981, the UB tour went to Washington, D.C. It was the week of the inauguration of Ronald Reagan. Even though I was not a fan of the new president, I appreciated the city's celebratory atmosphere. I visited the Rayburn Building, where members of Congress had their offices. I was excited to meet Bill Clay, a black congressman from St. Louis. Charles Rangel, who represented districts in New York, and Shirley Chisholm, the first black woman elected to Congress in 1968. Chisholm became a huge role model for me when I was in high school, and she later became the first woman to run for the Democratic Party's nomination for president. The title of her memoir says it all, Unbought and Unbossed. African-American political firsts mean a lot to me. It's no surprise, then, that years later, I used every trick up my sleeve to be front and center at the Democratic National Convention in Denver to see my baby, yes, Lord, Barack Hussein Obama become the Democratic Party's first black nominee for president of the United States. It was a last-minute decision. And every hotel was booked, of course. I stayed with my dear friend, Brian Norber, whom I had performed with at Six Flags Over Mid-America when we were both 17 years old. He even did my hair for this historic event, teased it up as only a gay boy in show business could. There was a bus for celebrities, but it was leaving for the Pepsi Center far too late for my taste. See, ladies and gentlemen, having been in a theater for 100 years, I knew that when an event is this big, get your ass there early. I got on a bus with 40 celebratory civilians. It was 6 hours before Barack Obama would accept the Democratic nomination.